You're listening to Red Setter, your guide to digital cinema, filmmaking, and cutting-edge imaging.
Hi, and welcome to this week's Red Setter. I'm Mike Seymour.
I'm Jason Wingrave.
So we have a really interesting show for you this week. We're going to do a couple of interesting things. We will be having a sort of in-depth discussion, I guess, from a what you described, Jason, almost like a panel of two discussing some of the implications from last week.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's obviously been a lot of stuff filtered out since last time, which was an incredibly busy time. A lot of information. And, of course, there's been a lot of water under the bridge, a lot of people poring over all the photos of very cleverly deciphered an awful lot of tech that hasn't really been revealed but has since been confirmed.
Well, plus some of those photos were actual photos of cameras as opposed to renderings. So
like the pictures of Tattoo, they're all real.
Actually, I was thinking about the inside of that Scarlett fixed lens, but we'll come back to that.
And the other thing has to be real.
That has to be real.
Well, it's a very bloody good render if it is a render.
We also have a really good interview coming up later in the show, which you did with Les from Cook Lenses. And I'm a big Cook lens fan and a huge admirer of the work that Les does in running that company. He's just such a knowledgeable guy, just really great guy.
Yeah, one of those people that obviously has been with the company and founded it and has, from ground up knows the tech. This isn't somebody sitting at the head of the board who, has the sort of marketing view of it. This is someone who knows, optics and light transmission and stuff. So, it's very interesting from a lot of areas.
Did I talk to you on Red Center about Dito, right?
No, but I have. You did an excellent chat with John on FX PhDOD podcast.
Yeah, right. Because since we didn't have much stuff in the show last week other than Red, I don't think I mentioned, but we don't have an interview with Dito this week, but Dito was actually in the country. This is the two-time Academy Award winner who actually invented, of course, the Dito light.
Dito light.
Now an entire range of lights that include area lights and a whole bunch of interesting stuff, and he gave just one of the most fascinating discussions. And I only bring it up because, like Les, if you guys get a chance to listen to one of these industry legends talk, like you might think, well, Dito lights, I've been bloody using Dito's for a year, or Cook lenses, S4 is good. But you find you always learn something from these guys, and it's not just sort of a matter of saying, oh, well, you can learn something from anyone, but these guys have such amazing insights and such depth of technical knowledge that I just find them fascinating.
Absolutely. If you see one of these captains of industry, if they're around and accessible, then collar them. At the SMPTE show, I was looking at the new Luma 2. I was just like, because I just have loved the Luma crane since it was first, used and invented for Dust Boot, and then used in, 1941, and just slobbering over American cinematographers for years of this before we got one in Australia. And one of the guys showing me had this sort of name tag on of Roberto something rather, and I said, "Oh, how are the guys? Who invented it? Who are they? Jean-Michel and the two inventors, Louvelou and Masseron." And he said, "Oh, I'm Jean-Michel." I said, "Oh my God, I'm just wearing somebody else's tag because I left my tag." And I said, "I nearly bowed down prostrate to the inventor of the Luma and had a great chat." So it was fantastic. This guy was demoing it and had literally built it, so it was I totally agree.
I mean, I was talking to Dito and he gave this talk. It included some amazingly interesting, I posted some of it on FX PhD's Dean's blog, but he gave, for example, a discussion about ultraviolet light causing skin damage. And I just imagine this would be something that if you're under studio lights for a long period of time, it'd be an issue. I never for a second thought that people could actually get injured in terms of dangerous exposure to UV in as little as a day or half a day.
That just blows me away. So obviously, clearly, yes, it wasn't dry technical stuff. It's the real world. He had some real world stuff to discuss and some very cool tech.
Yeah, and also he's just very entertaining speaker. Literally, like he'd be halfway through making a point, and everything was kind of set up. Like I had about, I don't know, 50 lights there, but most of them were turned off. And as he moved to each one, an assistant would get it prepped. And just as he picked up a Dito, and you'd think he'd be saying, well, the focusing, because, that's what Dito is, the focusing is all about it. And he's like, and they're pretty indestructible. Starts smashing it against this table and then throws it across the room into a bucket of water while it's on. And we're all like, whoa. And he's like, yeah, it's low voltage.
Low voltage, fine.
And then sticks his hand in the water and pulls it out and keeps on talking. It was very entertaining. But more than that, I just learned a bunch. So,
fantastic.
And well, Les's interview is no different. I really enjoyed listening to that. I think it was
excellent. No, he's a excellent speaker and knows his gear and knows his product.
So before we get onto that, I just want to do some news. And one of the things, Jace, that we didn't mention last week, simply because it was lost in the midst of the rest of the announcement, was the release of the official beta of Red Cine X.
Yeah, I completely missed this, which is... correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, but essentially this is the Rocket Cine X for the rest of us, essentially. It's based on that kind of layout and the way that software works if you have a Red Rocket card, but obviously it's independent of that hardware.
Yeah, I mean, actually there is a button or an option inside Red Cine X which will allow you to output onto another monitor real-time decoded images that are coming from the Red Rocket card.
Right.
So it's not a one or the other. Obviously, if you have the Red Rocket card, you can run the Rocket Cine. You can't run that software without the card. You can, of course, run RCX, which is what I call it, to avoid confusion.
Yes.
You can run that with or without the card. But yes, if you're on a laptop and you don't have any special hardware, feel free to run up Red Cine X, which is an early beta, build 44. It supports up to build 21 on the camera. And I've got to say, I really like it. Not probably at this stage, I'd say anything that you would consider to be a replacement.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, to avoid confusion, what does it, what's it, eventually when it comes out of beta, is it set to replace anything, do you think? I mean, it's like Lightroom or Aperture for R3Ds?
A little, yeah. The trouble with it is that there's no EDL XML type stuff yet.
Right.
Now, I say yet because this has the open architecture to allow third-party plugins, which is really, really going to make a big difference.
Yeah.
It's as if they've done a second version of Red Cine, but at the moment the second version hasn't eclipsed the first, but the architecture, having been rebuilt, will allow the flexibility for it to eclipse the original. But right now, you would use it for reviewing a magazine as a director. Mm-hmm. You might want to look at stuff. It's very user-friendly.
Right.
And it supports, importantly for us, it supports both the anamorphic mode, the ANH mode, but also ANA mode, but also the 4.5
RC widescreen
42,
mm-hmm.
anamorphic mode, which is all good.
Right. But, so, it's clip browse. As I say, I haven't played with it. It's completely been under my radar, but... It essentially, obviously, R3D browsing and great.
Much better R3D browsing than we've had before because it's possible to literally look at your file structures and it'll find any clips. And in the small little tiny icons, as it were, that would, if you run your cursor over it, it will actually run that clip for you.
Run the clip. Brilliant.
So we had a clip, for example, where Angie walked on white. So it's a completely white frame. She walks into shot and... in the middle of the shot, she's obviously there. In the end of the shot, she walked out of frame again. So if you look at the first frame, it's just white. And if you were to hold your cursor over that, it would play that clip. And if you move your cursor off halfway through, it would leave the icon set to Angie in the middle of frame, which is useful. Yes, you can then build up a timeline. Not an edit, but a timeline of clips. And you can apply looks. You can save looks. You can export stuff to... including Avid DNX HD, which is really significant. So.
Okay, brilliant. So if you're prepping stuff for Avid, you can basically...
It's a great Avid prep tool.
A whole bunch of go takes. You're only rendering your good takes.
Mm-hmm. You can do
You can do in and out mm-hmm. points, right, if you've got a long tail or if someone accidentally leaves it running. Excellent. Or you can just leave them from roll to cut, put them in a row, export it to Avid DNX HD or whatever you call it.
Yep. Yep, that's exactly right.
Brilliant.
And that's available, of course, from red.com.
And, of course, free.
And it's free, and it's early beta. So, I have totally crashed it several times, but it hasn't crashed my Mac. I just had to restart the app. Again, like we saw before with Red Cine, it does take over your whole screen. I should also point out that there is a Red Alert out there that will also support the 4.5 RC42. Wide anamorphic
screen.
Mode.
Right. Yep, spherical.
But it looks exactly pretty much the same as the original Red Alert.
Oh, that's great. Now, look, I really welcome this move to, I guess for me, being sort of the director brain, I think it's more, a bit more accessible looking, software, stuff that sort of works a little bit more like my brain.
You'll find this much simpler in terms of if you were trying to work out Red Cine,
yes,
and you came to this one, you'd be like, there's a whole lot of stuff missing. Well, no, actually, it's just a lot easier to work your way around.
Excellent. Oh, good. Well done.
So let's move our discussion now to the discussion I never got to have with you last week about just some of the implications, I guess, of what I have paraphrased as an epic announcement.
Yeah.
And I stand by my comments that if it is presented as an epic summary of what's going on, then you get some good scarlet information, but you mainly get epic information, and it's good epic information to have, especially about the stage rollout which went into last week. We won't I'm going to second guess you on this, probably not something we need to discuss the actual stages. That's probably been discussed,
right? Yes, I think that was brilliant, and that was obviously the crux of your chat with Ted last ep, was really sort of laying that all along the line, how it goes. Not a lot really has changed in that department really since then anyway, so yeah, I think we've definitely covered that. If you need to sort of have a bit more of an overview of the stages and how it might roll out, then yeah, go back and listen to episode 48. For now, we're in essentially all of the little sort of gems of gear and that have come out since then, and a lot of people have been brilliantly reading between the lines.
And also, I think answering your questions that you've been posting to us either in email or Twitter. I think the first one of those was somebody posted almost straight out of the gate. Nobody mentioned Red Ray. And in fact, I did sort of implicitly ask her that,
because
yes. I asked Ted, have any of the other products gone away or done anything? And I was referring to Red Ray and the other stuff, and
yeah,
he said no.
It's all still happening.
Yeah, but that wasn't the focus of the discussion.
Because Red Ray is still on, you know, red.com as coming 2009, of which there really isn't an awful lot of 09 left as we speak, as we go to record. Hopefully we'll see something soon, or sort of further ideas of what it's actually going to, what if there's any changes, or when we might start to see this stuff. I'm hoping that I'm imagining the plan is that maybe Red Rays will roll out. Maybe they'll be part of a beta program, or you know, maybe they'll start happening around the tattoo time, and you know, people will also have the chance to do the similar sort of beta feedback with tattoo as with Red Ray. Who knows? Reading between the lines is all I've got to do. I might just sort of step through some of the sort of, essentially what I'm probably going to do, there's a lot of bullet points here. This is essentially, I've been through 130 pages of stuff on the October 30 announcements and distilled it down to the absolute facts. So it's a little bit sort of all over the place, a little bit, but this is what I've been obviously been able to glean, and you can sort of chime in any time, Mike. Obviously, when we talked about, one of the interesting things that was that Ted talked about was this sensor adjust for adjusting essentially the back focus of the chips, which is obviously going to be, I presume, it will probably be across Epic and Scarlet. All of the chips is this five-way sensor adjust. What some people have said, is it going to be electronic? Is it going to be manual? So obviously, one thing's come out is that it is going to be manual. I imagine you've obviously got sort of three or four adjustment sort of hex keys or on the front of the brain to be able to essentially get the focal plane of the chip perfectly flat and perfectly correct to, not to the lens, but literally to the lens mount. I've had some not personally some issues, but I know people have done in testing have found, and actually after shooting have found stuff, footage that's been soft on one side. Have you heard ever any issues like that, Mike?
I haven't had those issues, though. As I think Ted said, it's incredibly small tolerance. We've said this on the show, it's incredibly small tolerance.
Yeah, and particularly obviously the tolerances get tighter as you go to the smaller chips, as you go to the 2/3 inch chips, and obviously the tolerances are tighter, oddly the wider your lens goes. If you put an 8mm, 16mm lens on, the tolerances for back focus are, you know, in way higher than if you're putting a 10-1 zoom on. So being able to sort of obviously adjust back focus, not just literally in and out, but to be able to sort of get it right, correct, left to right, bring the left-hand side of the left-hand side of the chip forward or backward, or cant it, you know, the top up or down, is basically obviously that's clearly something that they found out is needed. And I've had people have some issues with stuff across one or two cameras, have footage soft on one side, which is quite odd. So obviously that'll sort this stuff out. One of the things we've been trying to sort of decipher is the, as Ted was mentioning last step, the tap-tap focus, as he calls it, and what that actually means. Essentially, the camera brains are going to control the touch focus, and they're going to have tracking and traditional autofocus across all mounts that have, you know, the active focus control. I think this is obviously a conjecture at the moment. I imagine that functionality is probably going to be more for Epic than for Scarlet. But essentially, it won't. What I'd thought it might be tap-tap focus would essentially be just literally just, you know, obviously tap on the touch screen for one particular point, and it's kind of set and forget, and it's like a pre, almost like hitting, you know, the little sort of pre-focus button on your SLR before you roll. But I think obviously it's going to be there's going to be some tracking going on in there, so I'm not quite sure how they're going to do this, but obviously more to come on that. All brains are going to have HDMI ports on the actual brains themselves. It's not going to be, you won't need to have any of the I/O modules to be able to get HDMI out, as far as I know. This is an interesting point. Brains will have internet connectivity built in.
What does that mean?
Good question. Firmware upgrades will be incredibly easy. So maybe through USB port? I'm not sure. I haven't seen any USB ports on any of the modules, but theoretically HDMI internet connectivity built in, maybe through Ethernet? I'm not sure, but firmware upgrades are going to be a little bit easier rather than obviously putting stuff on a memory card. It's going to be, you're going to be able to plug your Epic straight onto the net.
Okay.
Excellent.
Surf the net on your Red.
Well, we talked about the fact they're all going to have 3.5mm jacks right on the brain. Obviously, what they're keen to do is have, even when you break it down to the bare minimum, the brains themselves are going to have be very usable as they are. 3.5mm mini jacks, two of them at the front for independent channels. So two channels, essentially, of balanced audio. These are going to support, obviously, mic-level control. No doubt through Redmote or through remote control, through the LCDs on the back of the camera. Even going to be phantom powered and, 48K, 24-bit depth. It's going to be some excellent audio being able to go in through the front of these.
So it won't have auto gain.
It won't have auto gain, and it won't have, unless you, depending on your, you have the option of full-size XLRs, which, many a cheer has been heard over that one.
So, Jess, I don't think I discussed much, obviously, point form-wise with Ted about the accessories, but we've actually heard a bit about those, including a new Red matte box.
Yeah, well, the Red matte box, they'd previously said, plenty of people making matte boxes, we don't need to. But, they are sort of doing an absolute cracker, made out of carbon fiber. It's going to take four... It's a fairly new size. I'm not sure whether it's entirely adopted, but no doubt they've worked it out that it's going to work with all of their lenses. But it's going to take a reasonably new format of 4x5.65-inch filters. So you can use existing 4x4 filters with 4x4 trays or with the tray adapters. At the moment, the matte box itself is only showing two trays, which it's, as we've sort of shown, and obviously playing with a two-tray matte box on moving day, mic, two trays often isn't enough if you've got lots of filters and you're trying to work wide open all the time.
You love working wide open.
Absolutely. It's the whole idea. It's the essence of photography. I mean, obviously, you've got... Exactly. 50mm 1.4 stills lenses, and obviously you've got the joy of being able to shoot at, 5,000th of a second. We obviously need to... Obviously, the whole idea is to stick with the sort of 180-degree shutter rule.
Especially if you suddenly have 800 as the new 320.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Everything's going to be a little bit faster, and we're going to be able to have the ability to... We're going to all the more need the ability to chuck a few more filters in there. So theoretically, it is a two-tray matte box, but we are going to... They've mentioned that there's a possibility to add extra trays later and sort of make it a little bit... Or at least probably a three-tray would be brilliant. Box is going to be $1,200, which is, a bargain for something obviously Red's developed and is made out of carbon fiber.
Yeah. Did I say something about a microphone? Are they actually doing a Red microphone or...?
There's two versions. Well... The one that they've mainly talked about is essentially something like a scratch microphone, which is, again, if you're just running the Epics or the Scarlets in really small mode, literally just the body and a CF card and, put a small LCD on it. They're going to have like essentially a scratch microphone, which will go on the front of the bodies. If you look at the pictures of Tattoo and Epic, there's two small 3.5-inch jacks at the front. So there's going to be like essentially a scratch microphone that will just snap into the front mic ports on Scarlett and Epic and give you, essentially, you'll always have sound. There's no actual mics built into the body, but you have the option to be able to put this thing right on the front and always record some sort of guide sound. There is in the gunner rig, which a little has been mentioned, no doubt some will come to light. If you look at the gunner rig and the sort of gunner mount, which is essentially looks like a front handle, inside there is a another kind of microphone. So essentially, it's like a little mini shotgun mic within that handle.
Within the handle?
Yeah.
Where did you find that out?
Oh, look, you know. 130 long
pages of bleeding through Red Crack.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's more coming out. And you can see that I think there's going to be like a follow focus electronic worked within there. So it's probably a stereo boom mic hidden within the gunner rig. But obviously more will come out about that. But it looks like it's a left-hand hand grip. So essentially you'll be able to grip a grip and microphone in one. And, yeah, so it looks it can be interesting. So plenty of sound options. They've clearly listened, so to speak. Now, the other thing, obviously, which is renders, which there hasn't been an awful lot of talk about, is the Red Station and the ability to have not just CF cards, but the addition, obviously, to essentially moving away from Red drives and anything that with moving parts to the new Red Mag 2.5 and Red Mag 1.8 modules.
So Red Station, is that a drive, or is that a mounting system to put CF card readers on?
It's a mounting system to put to read the two new systems of Red Mag 2.5 and Red Mag 1.8.
Now, but don't Red Mags actually have interchangeable mags?
That's correct. You have a SSD module that you would essentially buy for to stack on the back of your Red. That is essentially they've only announced the price for the 1.8 inch SSD module. That's $1,500. Now that's not actually the drives. That's actually the module to put the SSD cards in. Okay, so
when you say the SSD cards, we're talking about something not dissimilar to a CF card.
Yeah, I guess it's a RAM drive like the Red RAM, but a much smaller version of that.
Okay.
So and two versions, as far as we know at the moment, they only have announced one size or one capacity. The 1.8 is labeled 128, which we can only presume is 128 gigabytes. The Red Mag 2.5 at the moment is unmarked, yet to know what its sizes are. So clearly there's going to be multiple options for recording and Red drives, although they have also announced there will be a Red drive module, so you can continue to use your Red drives with this Red drive module, but obviously the move is to much smaller, more solid state, much more integrated within the body. You know, as you know, Mike, that the Red drive on the back and the whole cradle thing, or this whole, every time I go and grab a Red one, I always sort of grab the back of it rather than grab a panhandle, and I'm always sort of, and then it slips and the cable smashes into the on off button, and it's just
feel free not to borrow my camera.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry,
you did borrow my camera.
Sorry, mate.
Broke the LED screen, LCD screen at the back.
Yeah, as you well know. So, really welcome this move to solid state and great big capacities. And as we saw, no doubt we'll be slowly moving away from CF cards.
What am I going to put in my Red baseball cap if I don't have CF cards?
Your card out of your 5D Mark II, I guess. Okay, so, yeah, accessories. Obviously, there's a lot laid out there and there's a lot of prices. Some of them fairly expensive.
Really? I thought the accessory prices for the few that I'd seen were really good. I mean,
I think the one that sort of catches my eye the most is the Pro In-Out module, which is pretty much $3,000.
Well, I get that with my... If I
you
pick
do.
That option, right? If I pick
you
that
do.
Option, I get
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. True. Well, let's start, I will touch
what,
on some of the
modules. What is the difference between the Base I.O. and the Pro I.O.?
Okay, Base I.O. will have full-size BNCs, mini XLRs, which are perfectly fine, and obviously the whole idea of it is to keep it small, keep it light, you know, obviously, and also give you a more cost-effective option. Mini XLR plus RS-232. Now, I'm not quite sure how we're going to be able to use RS-232. Is that...
is it trigger?
Trigger. Some sort of drive control, some sort of...
I mean, obviously, you'd want, you know, be able to put up the top of a crane and run a cable. Is that...
Yeah, but that's... Theoretically, that's what would be the job of Red Mote. would be able to wirelessly roll and cut.
Or what would that be used for?
So anyway, there's GPIO and time code in and out. What's GPIO, Mike?
Okay, so that's a trigger.
Yeah, okay. So it's got a single auxiliary power out. Now, the Pro IO has digital audio inputs, has full-size XLRs. It has no audio outputs, but and there is an additional auxiliary power. So there's power out, there's full-size XLRs and digital inputs. So, yeah. There will be, as I mentioned, there'll be a red drive.
So I'm a bit slow here, but between the base and the Pro,
yeah,
what's the extra grand and a bit getting me?
Well, it's given you it's giving you full-size XLRs. This is probably the issue I have with it, that it's giving you full-size XLRs and an additional power out LiMo connector, and that's pretty much it. And digital audio in, rather. So I'm a little bit sort of not quite sure what the usage will be for those, but
It would be a lot to just get digital audio in.
So now,
The other thing, the batteries, because being somebody that flies a lot, I'm sure I had read somewhere in one of the millions of pages that there was something that pertained to aircraft travel.
Yeah, well, obviously the trick with the red bricks has been their capacity, and there's been a real issue
because of the lithium,
with the amount of lithium, and they're essentially the I'm trying to think, not FAA,
yeah, isn't it
NTSB? I'm not sure. One of the two have had guidelines and limits to the amount of, essentially the amount of watt hours these batteries can be that you can physically fly with. 100 watt hours has been the limit. So these are, I'm not sure if that's the limit actually, but essentially the XL battery packs, for the largest battery pack, for the Epic and Scarlet Brains will be 100 watt hours. So it's obviously that means you're totally unrestricted. And these things, you know, the idea is to have more smaller batteries, rather than one bigger one that's obviously a bit of a stitch up for travel. So that will be excellent. So no doubt, obviously, more to come and sort of pricing and specs on this sort of stuff. But it's, you know, good to know.
So that brings us, I guess, around to lenses, is some of the more interesting stuff.
Which is incredible. Obviously, this is what I was alluding to, the fact that there's a lot of detectives in there, Red User, really digging deep on a lot of this, a lot of the pictures, and working out a bit of the Easter eggs, I guess, that the guys have left for us to sort of decipher. Now, one of the biggest things would be the red electronic lenses. And someone was trying to work out, well, look, why are the markings going the wrong way? Second of all, why are they all quite spaced very evenly? And what's this sort of red marking on one footage? Nothing was really adding up, because obviously, theoretically, most of the time, if you've got physical markings, they're usually laid out fairly exponentially. That, you know, as you get more and more towards minimum focus, the markings get further and further away, and the distance between like 50 feet and infinity is really quite small. So if you look at
that's not the case on this one.
No, that's right. In this red lens, essentially, the one that they're sort of looking at is this 24 to 75. Red lens. Now, essentially, and this has been confirmed, is that the marking panel with all the focus markings is actually an OLED or organic LED panel. So all your markings are going to be clearly software changeable. So the whole idea is, first of all, they're readable in sunlight. Second of all, if you are in low light situations, they are going to be backlit, as we will touch on with the Five Eyes from Cook. The main thing is that obviously you are, because the whole concept of DSMC, you can go from stills to motion picture. We've had this constant issue of stills lenses going like Nikon lenses going the complete opposite direction for focus pullers and for focus travel than cine lenses do, and Canon going the same way as cine, but Nikon going the wrong direction. You therefore will obviously be able to change the focus direction of the lens to suit whether you're a Nikon bod or a Nikon brain or a Cine focus bod.
Oh, really?
And then obviously the other thing is that what we've had before with ordering lenses...
Well, it was obvious to you, but it wasn't obvious to me.
Well, the other thing is that I'm reading between the lines with all this stuff, but the other main thing is obviously all the way along with lenses that you guys have been ordering, you'd had to make that choice before you bought it. Did you want an Imperial or did you want a metric lens? Obviously, you can choose. You're going to be able to set custom focus points. You're going to probably, I imagine, be able to switch to an expanded mode. If you're doing quite critical focus, you could actually be ideal to, because the lens barrel, obviously with a lot of electronic lenses now, no physical connection between the internal workings of the lens and the outside ring. You can make it go opposite direction. You can make it be, I guess you'd almost like change the gearing so that it can be, you know, three whole turns of the ring to get from 3 foot to 6 foot if you really want to get really critical. It would be brilliant to have that kind of fine control of focus. So rather than having, you know, 50 feet to 100 feet be this little tiny 1 millimeter almost breathing on the focus puller, on the focus. You can have this, you can almost have, show it depth of field, you know, as you change your iris or as you change your focal length, you could actually have a depiction of what your depth of field is.
Cool.
Marked on the markings. I think it's just absolutely sensational. It's very, very clever. And takes it to, you know, it blows anything out of the water. That there's nothing I can think of that is anywhere near this kind of technology. So hopefully it won't take too long to actually see it, physically see it in our hands.
Did you glean anything really interesting out of the photo that I like, which is the inside sort of electronics of the fixed lens Scarlett? Because that was a fun, real photo.
Yeah, that was one of the other things that came out later on is they showed an assembly of the fixed Scarlett zoom, which is an 8-to-1 zoom. We yet to know what the focal lengths of it will be. But clearly what's missing is a zoom ring, which is literally just the one ring. Now, someone's hypothesized that perhaps that you can, you know, essentially that can be another soft ring and you can turn that ring into zoom or focus or iris, but I think essentially Jim's confirmed that the iris and zoom will be fly-by-wire, so I think this is probably just going to be focus, and you're going to be able to you have to do the iris and focus and zoom electronically, which I don't know. I hope it's not that, and you're actually going to be able to make that focus ring anything you like. You can turn it to focus if you really got a focus critical job, or you can turn it to zoom if you really want to have that grab the zoom ability. Because I think
I was going to say November 30th.
November 30th, true. Yeah. I should just shut the fuck up and
no, I'm just saying it's you know, anything that's Scarlett related, we'll find out a whole lot more on 30th November.
This is true. I don't know. I just hope that you're going to be able to grab the zoom, because that's going to be a bit of a deal killer. If the fixed Scarlett is perhaps aimed fairly and squarely at the HVX kind of market.
Not the soccer mums?
HVX wielding soccer mums.
Mums, yeah.
You're going to want to, I don't know, maybe that's me, but you're going to want to be able to have a zoom ring you can actually physically grab. So anyway, we'll see. So, yeah, I think that's essentially all the information that's there to be gleaned.
Now, these photos that we keep on alluding to, we're going to put in the show notes, right?
Absolutely. Yep, we'll have all this and all the bullet point notes that I've got here. And everything, pretty much everything that I've got here is I haven't sort of taken it from other people's second guesses. All of this stuff has been confirmed by Red. So, yeah.
Okay, so that's a really important point. What we've been discussing here, unless we've flagged it otherwise, isn't actually conjecture. It's actually maybe somebody's thrown something up and then Red has confirmed it in writing.
That is correct. Yes, exactly. What about my old Red drives? There will be a Red drive module, so you can use your old drives, that kind of thing. So forgive me sometimes if this is a bit rambly and it is a bit all over the place, but you know, that's what you get if you take 130 pages of Red User and try and distill all the facts out of it.
You so need to get out more.
Exactly. Yeah, I so do.
Okay. Well, look, I think that's pretty interesting. Just... I guess in summary, if we move away from specific little bits and bobs, with the 2020 hindsight of a week, Do you feel the same way about the cameras as we spoke a week ago?
Well, I guess I'm still a little bit disappointed that we don't, you know, we aren't a lot closer to actually physically having these things in our hands yet. When you just, as we alluded to last episode, when you just look at that exploded view of all the elements that go just into making the red mote, and you see what's come out just here, and what they're trying to do with the red lenses, and what they're trying to, you know, what's involved in the focus tracking, and what just literally in the, what's involved at the fixed scarlet lens assembly, there is a mind-bogglingly huge amount of tech and decisions and stuff going on in the background. So there's no wonder that it is, you know, it is taking a while. And obviously, we've had a whole podcast out of it, you know, since the December 3rd or whatever announcements from a year ago. How much water has been under that bridge from Nikon, from Canon? There's been a massive amount of stuff pushing all these changes along. You know, there's been since the first 3K for 3K, you know, Scarlett was announced, how much more options we have that are sort of obviously pushing, you know, red in you know, to up these specs, as they've said, the Scarlett and everything are all, you know, the specs are changing even now. So look, I can totally understand the delays, but it's again that double-edged sword. The more you show us, the more we really, really want it, and the more frustrating it is that we can't get our hands on it. Obviously, more time will tell in November when at the end of this month when we know a bit more about what we're going to, you know, what the rollout for Scarlett is.
When they're rolling out film cameras like Arri film cameras, back earlier in your career, what was there any kind of like, we're really keen to get our hands on the new camera, or was it like never want to touch a new camera until it's been bedded down for a bit?
Well, I think pretty much by the time there was. But, I mean, you're talking about a mechanical piece of equipment. By the time we got it, it was, you know, it was brilliant. I mean, there was a bit of stuff with early Platinums and Millennium Panavisions were sort of, you know, a little bit sort of clunky, and stuff had to sort of be, you know, things had to be redeveloped and accessories had to change. But, you know, it's a much more mechanical piece of gear. I don't think there's ever been any sort of real hiccups and wanting to, you know, let's not shoot with the new, you know, 435 or 535 because they're just too new. I think much of that sort of mindset has really come from, you know, from this new tech and from people getting, you know, getting old DPs across the line and old stuffy agencies and clients across the line. So, no, I don't...
I must admit, now that we've seen Epic and we'll soon see Scarlett, aren't you just kind of busting to see Genesis 2?
If they're doing one.
Oh, yes, if they were doing one.
If they were doing one. If I mean, I haven't heard anything about it, but that's nothing, not to say. I mean, from last I heard about Panavision, they were hundreds of millions of dollars in the red. Obviously, they're an LA-based company, and LA isn't, you know, is not doing, sadly, not doing brilliantly gear-wise. As we know with our chats with, you know, with Rodney Charters and people, that there's a lot of productions are shifting to digital acquisition. And what is also happening is that if anybody was going to be shooting on Genesis, Panavision really didn't see the stupidity of letting Sony, a competitor, help build their Genesis, because obviously a lot of people are, most of the stuff that's shot that could be shot on Genesis is shot F-35. So I don't know if we'll see a Genesis 2. We might, you know, I don't even know what's going to happen with Panavision. It's you know, it's scary.
Yeah. Okay. Well, changing gears now. I'm, as I said at the outset, just thrilled that you got a chance to talk to Les from Cook Lenses. I just want to make a couple of points at this. We'll have a chat when we listen to the interview. But the iTech stuff, I just couldn't be happier to be talking about that again. But there is a point in the discussion about the last third. You guys get into a bit of a chat about f-stop and t-stop, and I think just if you're listening and you're not familiar, you guys are so familiar, you don't actually ever stop and say that the T in a t-stop stands for transmissive or transmission in terms of an f-stop. So with that one piece of knowledge, the discussion is a little clearer between the f-stop and the t-stop.
Yeah. No, we sort of said we'd sort of unravel the mystery of that, and never quite did, but there was still definitely a lot of info in that discussion, particularly when you look at, as he discusses, the difference between older lenses and how much light is lost compared to how very little light is lost now, especially in the new range of Cooks.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the f-stop is the focal ratio or the relative aperture, and for most people, as you say, f-stop and t-stop now are so close together, thanks to, as you'll hear in this discussion, that t-stop and f-stop are almost interchangeable. But, you know, and there are just many of these floating around, like the fact that we shoot 35 millimeter, but we shoot, you know, 100-foot mags or film.
Yes, constantly. Yes, that always got me, being, you know, grown up in a sort of metric world, and I spent my time staring at one lens that had imperial and metric written on the same piece of kit. You know, let's set the lens to 25 mil and put the focus at 40 feet, and yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so, for many people, the difference between t-stop and f-stop may not be as significant as it once was, but I think it's fascinating true. To hear why it was, and particularly, obviously, as you guys discuss in this relationship to zoom lenses, any lens, of course, that has lots and lots of elements, as a zoom lens does. But if you just said T stands for transmission, I think that might have been slightly clearer when you get to that discussion.
Well, it's out there.
Okay, so let's cross to that interview now.
Well, look, thanks, Les, for taking the time. Really appreciate it. I'm going to jump right in there with the Five Eyes. Take us through how they differ, or how they're the same, I guess, from the S4s.
Well, you know, Cook's got a really long history. And over that history, we've developed something called the Cook look. And the Cook look goes back to the very first Pancro lenses that we built back in the 20s. And we've maintained that look throughout all of our lenses for the last, I guess that's 90 years. And the fives benefit from that. So, you know, the S4s are our flagship product at T2, and the fives are simply our Cook lenses, obviously, with the same Cook look, but they're T14. So our thinking is, you know, for most shooting, people will be using twos. Well, we'll get to that in a minute, with twos. And they really need that extra stop for low level or night shooting. They can use the Five Eyes. And frankly, if they don't need that stop, or they don't need even two, we have the new Pancro. So, and they're all color matched. And frankly, if you were shooting at maybe T3, you'd be hard pressed to know whether you were shooting on a 5, a 4, or a Pancro. You know, we went to great lengths to make sure all of our lenses cut in both color and quality.
Fantastic. And I've never been able to put my finger on what the Cook look is, but I guess it just comes down to bokeh. I don't know.
It's actually more than just bokeh. That's certainly part of it, how we deal with out of focus. But, you know, John Fowler, if you look at Film and Digital Times, can I plug his magazine?
Yeah.
He did a shootout with the 4, the 5, and the Pancro. And he really sort of nailed it on, he was describing what the Cook look is. Is he too sort of always thought it was mythical, and when he saw it in these still frames he shot, he could actually see it. It's a more dimensionality. A lot of DPs call it roundness, but it's a special quality, and it has a lot to do with our consistency of making choices when we design the lenses. And this goes all the way back to when the Pancros were first designed. You know, some people design lenses for the human eye, but if you think about it, the audience for the lens is not the eye. The audience for the lens is either the chip or the film stock. And the frequency response fortunately for us, the frequency response of chips and film stock is relatively similar, whereas the human eye is pretty much at the other end of that range. So by designing for the film stock instead of the eye, we end up getting a lot more information to the film. And also, by the way we color balance our lenses, it gives us a lot more detail, especially in shadow areas. We tend that we're not quite as contrasty as some of our competitors, but you don't get something for nothing in optics. And one of the things we get by not quite being as contrasty as we could, where some of our competitors are, is that we get more detail in the shadows.
There's a lot of other technology under the hood for the Five Eyes. Take us through the other parts that are new to them.
Well, the Five Eyes, again, going on the cookbook, but they're 1-4, so they work differently than the 4s. The 4s are what we would call a monobody construction, where we're moving the whole optical unit back and forth to obtain focus. We did that to keep the maintenance issues on the lenses simple for the rental houses. Or the ME users, to really try to make those as bug-free as possible. When you get to 1.4, you need to take other approaches. We've made a very serviceable lens, but it's far more complicated than the 4s are. So they're internal focusing, there are lots of acerics in them, and the quality of them at 1.4 is as good, if not better, than the 4s are at T2. So it's quite an achievement, adding that extra stop and improving, maintaining and/or improving the quality.
Fantastic.
In addition to that, when we did the 4s, I have to say we know we really nailed the ergonomic design, and the reason we know we nailed it is that everybody's copied us, much to my pisses me off. But I can't do much about it. But that tells me we really nailed the ergonomics, the way people want to work with the lenses. And we spent a long time coming up with that design for the 4s. When we embarked on the 5s, we said, well, what can we do to enhance? We don't want to change it because we know it's more or less the industry standard. So one of our guys said, we've got power in the lens now, so why don't we use it? And we said, well, geez. That's like a no-brainer. And so we added the lighting on the focus scale because, I can't tell you how many times, you've seen it probably too. An assistant, a focus porter, standing on the set with a flashlight stuck halfway in his mouth trying to see what he's doing.
Yeah, I used to build my own with, goosenecks and gaffer tape and mag lights. Yeah. And it's just...
It's all in the way.
Yeah.
It's just stuff in the way. So the fact that we now light the scale is... pretty amazing. And every cinematographer and assistant that has seen it just sort of opens their mouth and says, I got to use this. It's just going to make their life easier. And that's an important, we don't want to make changes just to make changes because that's sort of a waste of time. But we wanted to add function to the lens that cinematographers and especially assistants would find really useful to make their life easier, and I think we have.
Exactly. I mean, it's not a gimmick. You've got a lens that's actually really fast now, 1.4. It stands to reason often you're going to be using it in low-light situations.
Absolutely. So the reception the lenses have gotten has been really great. We're going to start delivering them actually before the year's over. We'll have just one or two sets out somewhere in the world and then really get serious about delivery starting in January, February. One of the other features in the 5s, and actually this is something we've been building into our lenses now for about 6 or 7 years, and that's the intelligence system, the slash eye. This is now finally getting really exciting. Metadata, which when we started offering it in the 4S4 series 5-6 years ago, was met with a lot of people looking at it saying, what the hell is that for? Over the years, that attitude has changed, that people now understand metadata is really useful. The problem, of course, is there hasn't really been a really slick workflow for the data, and there hasn't been a lot of applications that can use the data. So it's been sort of a chicken and the egg problem in that everybody can see the need for it now, but doesn't quite see how it all comes together. And I'm really pleased that right now we seem to be right at the critical point where everything is coming together. The red one, integrated the eye contacts in the camera just about from the get-go, I believe.
Yeah.
And it's just with their, however, you know, with all their other things they were doing and, you know, pretty much changing the world as we know it, implementing the eye and getting it turned on went on a back burner because they had far more, you know, far more important things to tackle. But I'm pleased to say that with the latest build, and I don't know if it's still in beta or if it's gone gold by now, but about a month ago they released, I think, 21 beta 1 or 2.
Yeah.
That now supports the eye data. And so when you put a Cook lens on it, and that would be a Cook 4, a Cook 5, or the new Pancros that will be out next year as well, they're all intelligent lenses, as well as the two little zoom lenses that Red has, the 18-50 and the 50-150. All these lenses can talk to the camera, and the camera can record the metadata in the files, so that post-production processes can use it. And this is really exciting. It's sort of like it's really the holy grail for us, because the data now is embedded right with the picture.
Yeah.
The other real push for the data has come from the Sony F35, which is also an eye camera and can record the data. And it's not quite as unique yet as the Red, because it's not using a file-based system yet, but it records the data and is easily synced back to the picture. So now we're also working in post-production with the foundry that makes a product called Nuke and the Pixel Farm that makes a PF Track. These products can utilize this data to help them do their job better, more accurately and faster. So it's almost a win-win for a producer. You know, recording the data really costs them nothing extra. And if the post-production processes can be more efficient and more accurate and therefore save money, it's like, you know, wow, why wouldn't somebody take advantage of this technology going forward? So we're quite excited about that. And of course, down in Sydney, you have Mike Seymour, that's a real advocate of this, and I know has been working behind the scenes to get metadata up and running.
I'm familiar with him. Now, obviously, in the background, while you've been developing this, it looks like you've been building a whole lot of other partnerships to get the whole iTech thing working together.
Absolutely. And I was going to mention that next, and that is the data from the lens is useful to a number of people, both in acquisition and in post. And we just mentioned the post. I should also mention that Avid supports eye data. They don't really use it, but they pass it through and they don't destroy it.
Which
is brilliant. One of the cardinal rules of metadata is don't delete it, because you never know who in the process needs. You may not think it's important, but the next guy may need it. So Avid is on board with it as well. But going to the acquisition side, we have people like Howard Preston at Preston Cinema, Larry Barton, Cinematography Electronics, C-Motion. C-Motion, Aton, SI2K, and the latest people to join the bandwagon has been Transvideo, the people that make the monitors. And they've actually come up, let me talk a little bit about all the other guys first. They all use it to their advantage. Like in Howard Preston and C-Motion can use the data in their lens control systems, so they don't have to learn the lens. The lens can talk directly to their control functions, and instead of having to teach for the control function to learn the lens, Lynch just says, hey, here are my marks, this is what I can do, and you can go right to work, and they can communicate very efficiently. Helps them do their job better. Larry Barton uses it with his Cinematography Electronics CineTape, and with that device, he basically can give you not only where your focus is, but his CineTape gives you where the subject is, and then with the lens data, you can easily see your focus and your depth of field.
Oh,
so he sort of puts it all together for a focus puller. So if the actor misses his mark, it's pretty simple to glance at his display box, and he can say and see that you're not even close to the edge of the depth of field. no problem, or, you know, you might be right on the edge or out of it. You either can adjust it.
That's brilliant. Interactive depth of field, so that as subject's coming forward, you can see the depth changing, I guess.
Absolutely. You can follow them. You can see where he is relative to the focus of the lens. It's a very innovative system. Our latest person to jump on the bandwagon is Transvideo, who have done a very clever thing in their latest monitors. They have the lens data, so you can see your iris, you can see your focus, you can see your depth of field. But now you combine that with a pictogram or a histogram of your picture, and you combine that with your actual picture, where you can turn on your his tools will allow you to turn on your blown out areas so you can see them. It will allow you to turn on your sharp focus areas so you can see those. And so now the DP can look at the new Transvideo monitors. I think they're Cine HD, I think they're called. When the DIT starts yelling for more light or open up the lens or to do something, instead of having to rely on just the DIT, he can look at the information on the screen, and with a little bit, I'm sure most DPs will instantly recognize the value, be able to say, well, no, this is the look I want, and I can maintain this by doing these other things, and I can see the effect here on the picture, on the monitor, not only visually, but I can see it technically by looking at the lens data and the pictogram. So it's a very powerful tool.
Well, we should obviously be remiss if we don't touch on the Pancros, of course, there, and how they fit within the line.
Well, thank you for that. You know, a lot of people have chosen to do cheap lenses for, I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but the cheap lenses for a lot of the Red users. We thought that was a pretty silly way to go, because the Red, you know, while the Red camera may be inexpensive, it's a real production tool, and you know, you don't talk down to these guys that are using it. They know what they're doing. It's you know, the Red has established itself in the last few years as nobody could even envision a few years ago. So, you know, the guys that use this camera deserve a lot of respect. And so what we decided to do to address this market is, instead of making a cheap lens cheaply, we made a really good lens inexpensively. And as I said earlier, if you compared a Pancro, a S4, and a 5i, a T3, you'd be hard-pressed to tell what lens you were looking at. So we built basically a mini S4. If you've seen the pictures, and
yeah, look fabulous.
We'll have some down in Australia in the not too distant future. When you put one in your hand, you know you have a real production tool. It's built mechanically just like an S4, in that it's a monobody. It's got cam focus. It's got the eye system. It's got a linear iris. The irises are in the same place. The focus gears. Basically, again, taking the ergonomic design of an S4 and just shrinking it down to a 2.8. Why could it get so much cheaper being a 2.8? Or, excuse me, so much less expensive being a 2.8? And the answer is, every stop that you increase or decrease the performance of a lens equates to a factor of 8 in tolerancing and assembly problems. So a Pancro is 8 times easier for me to build than an S4, and a 5i is 8 times more difficult. And already an S4 is pretty difficult. So that's allowed us to keep the price down and the quality up.
Well, obviously, this is a worldwide show. It's a bit hard to mention exact prices, but have you got like a guide as to where they sit price-wise compared to other things?
If S4 is your standard price, the 5 is about 25% more, and the Pancro would be about 40% of the 5 of the 4 price. So it's a little more than half less than a 4. So, you know, there's an old myth in the industry. And the myth was based on fact a long time ago, and that is, you know, the sweet spot for a lens is 2 stops down. So people want to get a 1.4 lens, and usually they're shooting a 2.8. Well, I will speak for Cook here, and I would say this is probably true of my competitors as well. that myth was well-founded a long time ago. Some of my competitors built lenses that were called really fast, but they weren't really designed wide open. They were designed two or three stops down, and you know they kept opening them up until the image got to be more or less trash, and they stopped, and they called them fast lenses. But nobody in their right mind, unless you absolutely had to, would use them wide open. And so everybody, the myth started based on this, that, you know, you needed to be two stops down when these lenses would start to clean up. Well, when we designed the S4s, we said, you know, that's a bunch of crap. We can design lenses wide open, to work wide open, and with the quality they need. And basically with the S4s, we did that. And if you go back in time and look at what people said, you know, about 10 years ago when they came out, it was basically, wow, we can work a T2 and don't have to worry anymore, because they really perform right from wide open all the way down.
That's a huge point, actually. I mean, that myth has been perpetuated forever, and even probably started in old stills lenses.
Absolutely. And you know, in the old days, there were a lot of reasons. But, you know, the technology's moved on. For instance, you know, in the old lenses, I mean, going back pre-coating days, they couldn't have a whole lot of elements in them, because every element, every surface of glass reflects about 4% of the light that hits it, an uncoated piece of glass. So you can imagine if you have 20 elements in a lens and you start from 100% of the light on the hitting the first surface, and you start subtracting 4% or taking 4% off every surface. And keep in mind, every piece of glass has two surfaces. You can see that by the time you get to the back of the lens, you haven't got a lot of light coming out.
Mm.
So that really limited pre-coated lenses to the number of elements they could have. And in fact, this is just an interesting aside. I don't know if you've ever wondered why most all other photography uses f-stops and motion picture uses t-stops.
You know, yes, I always have, and I've been staring at the t-stops most of my life.
I will explain that to you right now, and it's just an interesting quirk of the industry, and it has to do with coatings. In the early days, you know, you could easily have an F3 lens that actually was a T5.6, because it lost so much light just going through the lens. And keep in mind, in the film world, the processing is not done locally. It's done somewhere else. And so the lab really didn't care what the stop of the lens was. What they cared about is how much light actually got to the film. And therefore, we started using T numbers. You still want an F number, because all your depth of field information is actually relative to the F number.
Right.
It's not based on T.
Right.
So in the video world, when they started building video cameras, you'll notice they just went right to F stops. And the reason is they're doing the processing in the camera. So they can measure all that stuff right on the chip or the tubes or, you know, whatever they were using in the early days. And so the T number is, again, they're doing the processing there. They don't care. But in the film world, where the processing was done, you know, far away, they needed to know actually how much light the film got exposed with, not the cone angle, which is really what the F number is, the cone angle of light coming out of the lens. So that's where the T numbers started. And, you know, obviously today with modern coatings, I mean, a Cook lens with 20 elements in it, you know, our F1.4 lens, excuse me, our T1.4 lenses can be F1.35. So we're losing very little light.
Right.
And now with the sensitivity of film stocks, it really is not much of a difference between F and T anymore. But there was, historically there was, and T numbers have simply stuck around because of tradition.
That's incredibly small light loss.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, S4s tend to be T19 plus a little bit, and they're T2, F192, 193s, and they're T2s.
Amazing.
So, well, you know, it goes to the efficiency of our coatings now. You know, where with no coating, you lose about 4% of the light per surface. With our modern coatings, you know, you're talking about almost, you know, fractions of a percent. You know, we transmit well over 99% of the light that hits the surface.
Well, keep it up. It's fantastic. Well, I mean, it can't be easy in these times to actually go to the level of innovation you've done with these lenses rather than just pump out the same thing. This is tough times, so fantastic. Good on you for actually innovating in some tricky economics.
Well, thank you. You know, my theory has always been we have to move forward, and we certainly surprised a lot of people this year with coming out with two new sets of lenses. But, you know, if you don't innovate and keep moving forward, you're going to die. So, you know,
fantastic.
Jim at Red has shown the industry, you know, you can't stand still.
Well, thank you. Thank you for keeping running. We appreciate it, Les. And thanks for the time today. I really appreciate it, mate.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Anytime, just give me a shout. I'll be happy to do it.
So that really was a great interview with Les, and anytime Les wants to come on the show, he's very welcome.
Absolutely, as he said.
I'm surprised you didn't discuss all the other wonderful things like the Sunny 16 rule and stuff.
What?
The Sunny 16 rule.
I've never heard of the Sunny 16 rule.
You've never heard of the Sunny 16 rule?
No.
I'm not making this stuff up. Like, if you put a lens at f16 on a sunny day.
Yeah.
Then the correct exposure should be the ISO of the stock as a... So, like, 200 ISO stock would be 1/200th of a second.
Right.
At f16 on a sunny day, right? If you had 800 ISO stock, you'd be 1/800th.
Right.
You didn't know the sunny 16?
No, okay. So that's obviously more of a stills thing, I guess.
Well, yeah.
Obviously, for having 800...
Well, so much of this stuff is stills.
800
stuff.
A second. Yeah, that's true. No, never had...
No. Maybe that's because you don't have an SLR.
I don't. I
don't have an SLR.
That was my first camera, though, a Nikon Matt.
My first camera was a Millennium. I was joking. It was a joke. It wasn't. Yes.
I'll get one day. I'll get a camera again one day.
I must admit, the other one that I always found interesting is people not understanding why f-stops increase in the numbers that they do. You know how, like, they...
Second t-stop is also the double of the one before it.
Well, just that, you know, like you would go 2.8, 4, 5, 6, 8, 11, and that would be like, why did they randomly pick those numbers? And it's like the answer is they didn't randomly pick numbers.
Oh, pray tell Mr.
This is not...
Applied mathematics.
It's just obviously to do with the size of the aperture as expressed as an area. And so it's the... I mean, that's why it's like you're doubling the light, right? Every time you go up.
Yeah, you get that, and that's why every second stop is a double. 8 is a double of 16, 22 is a double of 11.
Yeah.
But I knew that was, but I didn't know why.
It's because it's to do with the radius of the actual, you know.
Okay, of the aperture.
Yeah, it's the, well, you're just looking at me like so friggin' disbelieving now.
I'm fascinated.
I'll put in the show notes for you.
Okay, that would be great. All right, so now what's the date? Let's see, it's 5th of November, so okay, we're a little bit far away from Scarlett announcements, so we'll have to think of something else to talk about for the next episode while we're waiting for that.
Thank you, yes. And thank you guys for listening, and as always, please keep your comments coming. Jason is on the Twitters.
I am. I'm Wingrove, twitter.com/Wingrove.
Yes, and I'm Mike Sim, although the best place to find me is over at FX Guide, where I tend to hang out a lot. And, of course, our course, which you are currently giving a terrific directorial course, is over at fxphd.com. And
yeah,
you're doing the directing
3-1 course. It's amazing. You guys are making... It's been fantastic.
It's rewarding, isn't it?
Oh, it's utterly rewarding, and more rewarding than I actually thought. Not that I thought that it would be an awful experience, but it has been quite amazing, and obviously totally freeing to be, doing... drama without creatives and without agency, and sort of, you know, having fantastic support from you guys, and working on a really great, really interesting project, which is still going, and we'll hope to sort of wrap that up by the end of the year. But it's been some fantastic questions from people in the forum. It's been a really interesting process to actually be not just teaching, but actually been making it along the way.
Yeah, no, totally. Actually, there's two other things I want to do. Our Twitter of the week, person that we recommend that you follow, and also my gear thing for this week, because...
the show's not long enough.
Sure, but the gear one's a fast one, and I'll come back to my Twitterer. The the gear is one that that is called Soulcam, S-O-U-L-C-A-M dot F-R, not dot com.
Will this show me a pic, what my true soul...
This is the coolest friggin' camera platform upon which to hang a camera off that that I've seen in a fair while. It's basically a Zeppelin.
It is a Zeppelin.
And it can hold, I think from, I'm not, my French is not, it's a bit rusty, I needed high school French. I think it will hold, you know, enough for a red camera, but it's bloody close. But you were pointing out that regardless of whether it does, because it holds Vipers and other bits and bobs,
yeah,
is that a smaller version of this for a Scarlett would be possible, absolutely, given the Scarlett's reduced weight.
Can you imagine? Scarlett's going to change so much of this stuff. Steadicams are going to get smaller. Dirigible camera mounts are going
to
get smaller.
But you've got to go to this site to see some of the amazing shots these guys have got.
It's utterly beautiful.
As soon as I saw this, I was like, I want one of these.
And the interesting thing about it is that, first of all, because you're not dealing with rotor blades and dealing with something that potentially can fly very fast, they are not flying it fast. A lot of these photos, a lot of the moving image is very slow and very... the Soul Cam is actually quite a nice name for it because, A, you can... because it doesn't move fast, it has a very beautiful sort of languid feel to it. People, because obviously if you have a helicopter that can do 200 million knots, then magically everyone shoots helicopter footage at 200 knots.
Yeah,
this is... And the other thing is this is some... getting very, very close to some... safely getting close to some amazing-looking buildings and architecture. You would need a 90-foot crane mounted on the top of, 3,000-foot building, 300-foot high.
There's some great shots they've got, for example, like warehouses. And another one, which is gorgeous, is just hovering over surfers, because there's no downdraft.
Yeah,
from
there's no downdraft. There's no safety issues. It's a very passive, very soft, slow beauty. It does lend itself to some beautiful imagery.
So not exactly a gear recommendation that you buy,
no,
but if you get a chance to shoot with it, or if anyone's listening that knows the guys at Soulcam, just tell them that we think they're
marvelous.
Yeah,
well, I think we should have a chat with these guys. It's pretty amazing. They've got some 3D and stuff as well. It's quite interesting. I don't know how you go with a windy day, but
it's got motors.
Absolutely.
You can fly it. It's not just a hot air balloon.
No, when you take away the safety of the safety issues of rotors and incredibly scary stuff like that, then you are free to do some quite amazing stuff. So I didn't imagine this was going to look as amazing as it does, but it's definitely worth a look.
And so my pick of the week of following on Twitter is one that I'm surprised we haven't done before, because stupidly small number of people follow this person. It's Graham Natras himself. He's on Twitter. He posts. He listens to this podcast. I'm sure he doesn't religiously listen to it, but I'm very pleased he listens to it at all. But Graham's a great guy and terrific guy. He actually lives in Canada. But G Natras, G-N-A-T-T-R-E-S-S. He's in Ottawa, Canada.
And he's English, is he not?
Yes. Well, I guess he's English. I mean, he certainly doesn't have a French accent.
No, he sounds English and yet living a Canadian.
Happily living
English-born Canadian.
Yes. And, image processing magician.
Absolutely.
But Graham Natras, the man behind R3Ds. If you follow him, he's a very good person for pointing out interesting things in podcasts. In particular, he pointed out that perhaps and the reason I'm mentioning is part of an apology. I haven't been able to verify this, but he was saying that when I went at TED, which, by the way, I got quite a lot of rats over for picking on a guy who just had a heart operation, that I said that they benefited from Canon publishing the specs on their lens, and he pointed out that he didn't think actually Canon had published the specs on their lens, and then in fact it was just derived by somebody sitting there with a probe.
That's what I had imagined. It's reverse engineered.
So if that's the case, then I apologize not only to Graham but also to Ted.
So Twitter, Ted. So why don't you Twitter Graham and ask him?
But good on you for laying into Seymour. Graham, terrific guy. As you know, we've spoken to him in the past, and follow him on Twitter.
I think it's fantastic. I think it's probably one of the few actually sort of read people that are actually on Twitter, really.
He's completely accessible. I mean, he can't obviously answer a ton of stuff, but really, honestly, if he speaks, which he does, every day, I think, if not several times a day.
Yes.
You'll always get terrific references. And I quite often find that he's flagged something really interesting on the net. But, of course, Graham also has a company that produces software plugins for Final Cut Pro and stuff, nothing to do with Red.
Yes, absolutely.
And I'd recommend those as well.
That was the first I knew of him, the plugins for Final Cut Pro. Yeah, absolutely.
And so you can check those out over at Natress, which is natress.com. And he has film effects and standards conversion stuff. And, you know, I mean, this has got nothing to do with Red. It has sort of preceded it, but it's the same... genius behind the curtain that that did these. This site doesn't get updated a lot, but it's got some really good tools in there.
Yeah, absolutely, because they just work.
They just work.
Mm.
That's it for this week.
Thanks, guys. Thank you, Mike.
Until next time, talk to you later. I'll see you.
See ya.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us, red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2009, FX Guide, LLC.